Bye-bye.
This is John in Yellow, and you're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC Acra.
The Catskill Town Board meets every first Tuesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. at the Catskill Town Hall and holds a committee meeting the third Wednesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. You can turn out in person at the Catskill Town Hall to speak at these meetings or tune in to a live web stream through the Catskill Town Board and WGXC. Go to wgxc.org/listen or click on the listen button at wgxc.org to tune in to any of the Catskill Town Board meetings, the first Tuesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. and the third Wednesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. at wgxc.org and townofcatskillny.gov.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by Sun Common, supporting vibrant communities across New York for over 15 years, offering custom solar installations for homes, farms, and businesses. Information at suncommon.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Igers Kildas and Louisa Sabin Kildas of Hudson, New York. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to wgxc.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acra with the WGXC Daily News for Monday, April 10th. Go to the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org for more information about any of these stories. Nick Reisman reports for New York State of Politics that Governor Kathy Hochul and leaders in the state Senate and Assembly still can't agree on a budget and are going to vote for a second budget deadline extension on April 10th, giving them another week to negotiate. Sources told reporters that the spending bill that will pass April 10th is identical to the first extender, except there is also $9 million set aside for AIDS drug assistance to offset the impact of changes in the Medicaid program. Passing the bill is necessary to meet the payroll for 83,000 state workers. Changes are still being discussed to the state's bail laws, too, Hochul explained, saying, quote, "We're working very hard because my priorities have been clear from the beginning. I'm going to work to make sure the judges have the discretion they should have," unquote. Read more about this story at New York State of Politics. Chris Gilardi reports at New York Focus that the New York Civil Liberties Union, Prisoners Legal Services of New York, and Rutgers Law School's Constitutional Rights Clinic filed a class action lawsuit against the Department of Corrections and Community Supervision on April 5th because prison officials are still putting inmates in solitary confinement even after legislators largely outlawed the practice. Several recent media reports back up the allegations that the prison agency has been sending people to prolonged solitary confinement on illegal terms. The Humane Alternatives to Long-Term Solitary Confinement Act was enacted in March 2022. Karen Murtaugh, executive director of Prisoners Legal Services, said in a statement that, quote, "This litigation seeks one thing and one thing only, enactment of the HALT law as written," unquote. The story says, quote, "A New York Focus analysis in October found that over 6 months, state prisons sent people to prolonged isolation almost 1,200 times, nearly one in five solitary sentences, for infractions that definitely did not fit within those parameters," unquote, of the HALT law. Read more about this story at New York Focus. Brendan J. Lyons reports in the Times Union that Governor Kathy Hochul and New York Attorney General Letitia James filed a brief April 7th in support of a Democrat-led court fight seeking to force the redrawing of New York's congressional boundaries in time for next year's election. The boundaries were redrawn after the 2020 census with court orders and controversy, and aren't scheduled to be drawn again until after the 2030 census count. The state's Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee brought a lawsuit in a state appellate court in Albany to have the Independent Redistricting Commission redraw the lines before the 2024 congressional elections. James said in a statement that, quote, "Our state's constitution makes it clear that an independent body with participation from the general public is charged with drawing maps for congressional districts. Relying on a process with no accountability and with limited time for public input is not how we engage the public and ensure their interests are addressed throughout this process," unquote. So far, the Democrats have not persuaded the court, as on September 12th, State Supreme Court Justice Peter A. Lynch rejected the petition and said there was no authority for the Redistricting Commission to issue a second map. So the Democrats are now appealing, under the blessing of the state's highest elected Democrats, Hochul and James. Read more about this story in the Times-Union. And the Daily Freeman reports that tolls increase May 1st on the New York State Bridge Authority's Hudson River crossings, including the Kingston-Rhinecliffe, Mid-Hudson, and Rip Van Winkle bridges. The Bridge Authority is raising the tolls by a dime for each of the next 4 years for E-ZPass customers. Those with the pass will now pay $1.65 to cross the bridges from west to east. Anyone driving through without the E-ZPass will have their license plate read electronically and will be sent a bill by mail after May 1st that is 15 cents larger than before, now at $2. Bridge Authority officials say that, quote, "tolls are reinvested back into capital improvements on the authority's spans, ensuring that these critical pieces of infrastructure can continue serving the Hudson Valley for decades to come." Read more about this story in the Daily Freeman. And read more about any of these stories in the WGXC newsroom, wgxc.org.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Monday, April 10th. 27.3% of the way through the year, we have 72 days left until summer. Local early morning temperatures range from 24 degrees in Steventown to 32 in Tannersville. Regional average soil temperature is 43 degrees. And we have to deal with a double-edged sword. Even though we have another nice spring day ahead, we still have to deal with pollen, which will be at medium levels today and at high levels by Thursday. When you head outside today to grab the diphenhydramine, bring those sunglasses and maybe get those gardening supplies. After today's high of 65 degrees at 4 p.m., frost chances, at least for most of us, seem to be on the way out. Good planting time for things like kohlrabi and lettuce. Moving things inside and covering them up is still a good idea, as tonight we'll see a low of 39 degrees. Tomorrow, a little windy, so grab a jacket as we watch temperatures hit 71 degrees by 3 p.m. 56 degrees overnight takes us into a still dry Wednesday with a high of 73. Thursday, we're gonna have a high of 83. This is it, folks. Let's call it the spring steamroll. Remember, when we finally do get rain, those lawns are gonna explode with life. Today's river temperature will be 44.2 degrees. Today's tide strength is average. Sunset today will be at 7:15 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 6:19 a.m. Looking way up, we see a possible unexpected coronal mass ejection impact yesterday could cause some geomagnetic disturbances today as we pass through its wake. Solar wind speed is currently 356.7 kilometers per second at 16.3 protons per milliliter. Radio propagation conditions are currently terrible till dark, then fair below 8 megahertz overnight. The 24-hour predicted KP index is 3. Quiet. The current sunspot number is 52, and this has been the Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
Just what is it that you want to do?
Well, we want to be free. We want to be free to do what we want to do. We want to be free to ride. And we want to be free to ride our machines without being hassled by the man.
walking down the road, everybody yelling, hurry up, hurry up. But I'm waiting for you. I must go slow, I must not think bad thoughts. When is this world coming to? Both sides are right, then both sides murder. I give up.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The plaintiffs here are going about trying to ban medication abortion nationwide through the courts instead of through the court of public opinion because they know they wouldn't win there.
Rachel Fay with abortion rights group Power to Decide thinks two judges' conflicting rulings on abortion drugs are likely headed for the Supreme Court. A federal judge in Texas invalidated the Food and Drug Administration's 23-year-old approval of mifepristone, but a judge in Washington state ruled the abortion pill is safe and effective and told the FDA to keep it on the market in the 17 states where it's sold. More than half of all abortions use prescription medications. Meanwhile, Arizona State Representative Lorena Austin is one of several there pushing back against a bill prohibiting use of preferred gender pronouns. Though the bill faces a likely veto should it pass, Austin says it's still a targeted attack on a vulnerable population.
I have to tell you that I cannot imagine being 14 again and having a bill like this come through, because I grew up in a community where I knew I would not be accepted. I knew I would not be supported in my home or in public.
The Republican sponsor says the bill would let parents help their children. According to the ACLU, over the last 5 years, the state's lawmakers have passed 4 laws that restrict transgender people's rights. In North Dakota, Governor Doug Burgum is considering several anti-transgender bills that the legislature just approved. 2 would ban drag shows and gender-affirming care. Burgum has vetoed similar legislation in the past. Barry Nelson with the North Dakota Human Rights Coalition says Republican lawmakers are being swayed by out-of-state groups and ignoring their constituents.
I don't believe the average North Dakotan believes in government overreach and targeting vulnerable individuals.
Several gun safety bills are up before the Nevada State Legislature. One would prohibit firearms within 100 yards of an election site. Another would raise the age limit to buy an assault rifle from 18 to 21. A third would prohibit firearms for anyone convicted of a hate crime in the last decade. State Senator Dallas Harris calls that last one a no-brainer.
The rising tide of hate and hate-motivated violence has led the FBI to elevate that type of violence to a top priority threat, singling out white supremacy as a major driver of those attacks.
Texas Governor Greg Abbott is considering a pardon for an Army sergeant convicted of killing a Black Lives Matter protester in 2021. Daniel Perry ran a red light and drove at a group of protesters in Austin, one carrying a legal firearm. Perry shot the armed man and claimed self-defense. Former Attorney General Bill Barr says there is good evidence his former boss obstructed justice when referring to former President Donald Trump's mishandling of classified documents, including dodging a federal subpoena. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. Recent revelations from a disgraced cryptocurrency CEO gives us a glimpse of just how much campaign money flows into our election system, both what gets reported and what's called dark money. In an interview with journalist Tiffany Fong, FTX crypto exchange CEO Sam Bankman-Fried, now in custody in the Bahamas, admitted that he had not only given $40 million to Democrats and Democratic PACs to fund primary races, but he said he also gave an equal amount of dark money to Republican candidates. It's not yet known which dark money organizations, but typically 501c3 and 501c4 nonprofits, limited liability corporations, and other instruments are used to shield donor identities. Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington has since filed a campaign finance complaint with the Federal Elections Commission. Crew suggested that Bankman-Fried contributed as much as $37 million more than was reported to the FEC, and says that while the U.S. Supreme Court's Citizens United decision allows independent expenditure to groups, it doesn't allow those groups to pass through donations directly to candidates. Several politicians, including Arizona U.S. Senator Kyrsten Sinema, have reportedly returned money given to them by Bankman-Fried. We have links to the campaign funding transparency website Open Secrets and more details on the allegations at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. For the American Democracy Minute, I'm Brian Beal.
Here is the weekly WGXC Animal Report, all about non-humans seen or heard or evidence of at Wave Farm this week. And the birds have been back in full force with the warm temperatures. You can hear some of them now. We've also seen more than our share of deer this week. First couple of rabbits have emerged. And there have been sightings of the koi in the Wave Farm pond. course, we've also heard many spring peepers. At Wave Farm this past week, a couple of woodpecker sounds this week too. Tune in next week for more about the non-human activity at Wave Farm on the radio at WGXC Acre. There's one of those woodpeckers. Catskills' Brian DeWan performed Friday, April 7th at Spike's Record Rack on Main Street in Catskill. It was the fifth anniversary of the record store. And here is one of the songs Brian DeWan performed at the show that was broadcast live on a WGXC webcast at WGXC.org.
I had a horse and his name was Bill, and when he ran, he couldn't stand still, he ran away one day, and also I ran with him. He ran so fast that he could not stop, he ran into a barber shop, and so exhaustionized with his eye teeth in the barber's left shoulder. I'm going out to the woods next year to hunt for beer and not for deer. I am, I ain't, I'm a great sharpshootress. At shooting birds I am a beaut. There is no bird I cannot shoot in the eye, in the ear, in the teeth, in the fingers. In Frisco Bay there lives a whale. She eats pork chops by the pail, by the half box, by the pill box, by the hog's head, by the schooner. Her name is Lena, she's a peach. Just only food within her reach, or toothpaste, or candles, or chocolate ice cream sodas. She loves to laugh, and when she smiles, you just see teeth for miles and miles, and tonsils, and spare ribs, and things too fierce to mention. She loves no games, so when she plays, she rolls her eyes for days and days. She vibrates, she yodels, and breaks the Ten Commandments. A man went up in a balloon so big, the people on the earth looked just like a pig, like a mice, like a katydid, like flies, and like fleasins. The balloon went up with its bottom side higher, fell on the wife of a country squire. She made a noise like a dog hound, like a steam whistle, and also like dynamite. Oh, what can you do in a case like that? Oh, what can you do but stamp on your hat, or an eggshell, or your toothbrush, or anything that's helpless? I like to go down by the brook with a fishing line and hook, and fish for clams and oranges and bananas. And if there is a sign so near that says no fishing goes on here, I'll hunt for buttons and for turnips and for candy.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
We're talking today with Michael E. Wall, who is the Executive Director of the Energy Justice Network, and along with the Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, on April 3rd, they filed a petition to the United States Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, that it should finally start requiring waste incinerators to report their toxic chemical emissions as part of the agency's toxic release inventory. Michael, why is this an important issue?
So, thanks, Mark. This is an important issue because a lot of times there are things that come out that talk about what toxic exposures are there in a community. For example, ProPublica did a great toxic map for cancer risk about a year ago. And if you zoom in and look at that and try to find your community, well, a lot of communities won't see things that should be on the map because some of the most toxic industries, waste incinerators, have never had to report to the database that EPA uses that that map was based on, which is the Toxics Release Inventory. So there are just a lot of places where the largest or one of the largest polluters is a trash incinerator in any given city or county, and that data is just not there. So that's part of it, is that we're not getting the full story. Another part of it, though, is that that database goes more thorough than other ones. So there are other places you can find that information for what goes into the air, but you can't get in any place the information on what toxic chemicals go down the drain or into ash that gets dumped in a landfill or some other place that is also inappropriate. And that is one of the major new disclosures we'll get once this once EPA requires this industry to report to this database. So for example, if you're living in a landfill community and you're getting ash from somewhere, you might be able to figure out how many tons of ash from what incinerator, but you won't know how many pounds of mercury and dioxin and lead and arsenic are in that ash. Now they'll have to start reporting that information.
So we were talking earlier, and you know, you stated that, you know, some forms of incineration are, you know, presently required to cover. We thought particularly that the Norlite has this waste incinerator, which is, you know, also an aggregate production facility, probably is already required to report some of this. What are some of the other incinerators beyond, say, garbage incinerators that would fall under this proposed rule?
Sure. So in the Clean Air Act, there's a section called Section 129, and that covers several different types of waste incinerators, and that is what has been exempt from the start. So plants like Norlite, they have to report because they're either a manufacturing sector or mining sector, or if they were a standalone hazardous waste incinerator, they would have to report because of that, because that falls in a different section of the law. But all the types of incineration that are not technically classified as hazardous waste, but are still dangerous, are the ones that are exempt. So that's what we're asking them to add. And that includes large and small trash incinerators, hospital or medical waste incinerators, sewage sludge incinerators, what they classify as commercial and industrial solid waste incinerators. They also have a category called other solid waste incinerators. And finally, pyrolysis and gasification units, which are types of incinerators that they often say are not incinerators. The industry likes to say they're not incinerators, but they're still defined and regulated that way and are very similar to more typical incinerators. These are the advanced recycling or chemical recycling plants that are often trying to process plastics into fuels that we keep hearing about.
Now, I actually was involved in the effort to shut down the Albany Ansys garbage incinerator in Arbor Hill back in the mid 1980s. But, you know, at that point, it certainly seemed like the State Department of Environmental Conservation was very pro incineration. And, you know, one of their arguments, well, burning things at a high temperature is the best way to destroy them. But does a lot of the things that are shoved into these, you know, different type of incinerators, including garbage incinerators, are they actually destroyed or do they emerge some other way?
Right. So there is a lot of public relations around this industry. There's a long history. When I first got involved, when I was in high school in 1990, I was hearing in the news about a trash to steam plant that would be built in my home township. And I was in favor of it. I thought, well, if they could turn bad things into innocuous things or even good things, then why not? Well, it took until I started studying it to realize that is not what they do. They're not, people are not throwing ice cubes in the trash can. We're not only getting steam out of smokestacks. Same thing when they call it waste to energy, like they do for a lot of trash incinerators that produce modest amounts of electricity, because really what they're doing is they're turning trash or other kinds of waste into toxic ash and toxic air emissions. So every pound that goes in comes out, and all the bad things that go in, all that mercury, arsenic, there's PFAS in there, all of that stuff comes out. If they're elements, they won't change. But if they're PFAS, some of it might get broken down, but you don't destroy it. You just change its former location. So you put a PFAS molecule in there, and it's that fluorine in there is still going to come out, if you're lucky, as hydrofluoric acid, which is still not a very lucky thing to be breathing. So that's one of the chemicals that has to be reported to the toxic release inventory. And we hope to make that disclosure more available.
Now, I know you realize you're national, but you've done quite a bit of work, I know, in Albany County about air quality issues. Mm-hmm. So what are some of the, you know, facilities we're looking at in New York? I believe there's quite a few garbage incinerators. I met one of your staff people recently who was talking about the incinerator down in Westchester County. I'm pretty sure there's one up in the Glens Falls. So, you know, what are some of these, you know, facilities that we know about in New York State at this point?
Sure. So New York is now tied with Florida for the number one, status of number one in the number of trash incinerators. Florida used to have 11, but one closed. So now they're down to 10. And New York has had 10 for quite a while. Back 12 years ago, there were still these 10 incinerators operating. And at the time, the New York DEC, the Department of Environmental Conservation, studied and found that compared to the 8 coal power plants that used to exist in the state, all of those shut down, but the 10 trash incinerators are still running. The trash incinerators were far more polluting per unit of energy than the coal power plants in the state. On mercury, it was 14 times more, which is pretty astounding. So these 10 incinerators, there are 4 on Long Island. There are 3 in the Hudson Valley. Those 3 are all run by Wheelabrator, the second largest incinerator company in the country. And like you said, there was one near Glens Falls, it's actually in Hudson Falls, and there's one in Poughkeepsie and one in Peekskill. And then there are 3 others in Western New York. So there are those, plus New York also is one of the top states in sewage sludge incinerators. So you have those scattered around the state as well, and some other types that might fall under this as well.
Now, in terms of the toxic release inventory, is this a case of, you know, self-reporting by the, you know, the polluters as to how much they're emitting, or there's actual, you know, independent smokestack emissions that take place?
Well, I wish I could say for anything, and even if the toxic release inventory becomes a requirement for this industry, that would change how things are tested. It will not do that. The testing in this country is horrifying if you realize what really goes on. None of this is being done by anyone independent. Companies pay for their own engineering companies to do the tests for them. So that's not independent if they're the ones paying the bill. It's not the state that comes in to do it. And for any toxic chemicals, they are not monitoring on a continuous basis. They will test about 3 or 4 things at most smokestacks with continuous testing, and that stuff that is not considered toxic, but is carbon monoxide, nitrogen oxides that trigger asthma attacks, and sulfur dioxide that also causes respiratory and other problems like acid rain. But when it comes to mercury, dioxins, most other chemicals, all these toxic metals, acid gases, those things, if they're tested at all, and usually about maybe 8 to 10, maybe 12 are tested at a lot of facilities like incinerators, they test them one time a year under their best behavior. And they're not even allowed to do the test when they're having worse emissions, like during startup, shutdown, and malfunction times. So they basically create the best case scenario, run their test. They run a few of them. They can even and often do discard results that come out really high because they say, oh, there was an anomaly there. Okay, we'll rerun the test. And then they say, this is what we're like all year, which is complete baloney. And we know that because we've seen studies like out of Europe, where the most toxic chemicals known to science that largely come out of incinerators, dioxins, the actual amounts of dioxin when you use continuous testing, which we don't do in this country, in one study are 30 to 50 times higher than what we think they are when we test one day a year.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. And so we've been talking to Mike Ewall, Executive Director, Energy Justice Network. You have a website people want more information?
Yes, if you go to energyjustice.net.
Thank you very much. This has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine. This is Marcia Lazarus sitting with retired SUNY Albany English and Women's Studies professor Judith Barlow. Judy and I are part of a Jewish feminist brunch group which has been meeting for over 30 years. Each month we discuss a topic related in some way to being Jewish feminists. When we met in March, the Jewish holiday Passover was approaching. Every year on the first night of Passover, this year, April 5th, families and groups of friends gather to enjoy a traditional Passover dinner and to retell the Exodus story. Our topic is really a discussion about empathy, seeing the world through others' eyes. During the retelling of the story, Jews are instructed to tell the story as though they themselves had been enslaved in Egypt and that they themselves wandered in the desert for 40 years. We were each asked to respond to recent comments made by Ari Shapiro during a WAMC interview. Shapiro described the act of listening to others' stories as an act of empathy. Judy, I know to expect quite a diversity of reactions, perspectives. Still, I was intrigued by how you started out. You cited a recent New Yorker magazine article, The End of the English Major.
This has been a concern of mine for many years now, that the humanities are disappearing. According to this article, UAlbany's degrees in the humanities have dropped almost 75%. When you read a book, when you look at a painting, when you listen to music, you hear somebody else's vision or you see somebody else's vision. You get to travel in a world that's not yours, and you get to find out that your perspective is not the only one. Teaching, one of the greatest things about teaching is how much you learn from your students. Early on, I was teaching Lillian Hellman's Little Foxes, and I made the point that Addie, the African-American servant, is the most appealing character in the play. She's the moral center of the play. And at the end, she takes the young white girl, the teenager, and agrees to take her away from her toxic family. And pretty early on, a hand went up, and the student asked, "But where's Addie's story? Was Addie really that devoted that she was going to leave her family and her community to take this white girl to someplace safer? How come we don't know anything about her?" Another time, we were doing a book called Rachel and Her Children by Jonathan Kozel, and it's about interviews with families in a homeless hotel. I mean, just reading the book was enlightening. One woman said that all she wanted was a living room, a kitchen, and a nice bedroom. And I thought, all she wants is what I have. A few weeks after we did that, students handed in their essays. One of my students had been there. She had completely repressed the memory until she read the book. And she wrote very movingly about how awful it was and how it affected her and her brother and her sister. So I got not only the perspective of the woman that Kozel was quoting, but also from a student in a way that you can't even get in a book. So you have the advantage of not only getting the perspective of the writer, but also of the other readers who don't see it the same way you do. I also taught a lot of writing courses, and students very often found out things about their writing and about themselves just in writing. In many cases, you don't know what you think until you try to articulate it. I can't tell you whether these days whether I could recognize an AI-written paper or not. I have never been challenged to that. But the very act of their putting down their story, somebody else's story, their reaction to a painting, they see that the act of writing, like the act of speaking, is a way of understanding what you think.
Judy, you joined the SUNY Albany faculty in 1973. in both the English and Women's Studies departments.
My home department was English. Women's Studies was just beginning at that point, and I joined that as an adjunct faculty, and I was also adjunct in the theater department. So I got around.
What drew you to this work?
I had always loved the theater, and that was my specialty, and I wrote my dissertation and what became my second book on Eugene O'Neill. But all along I wondered, how come we weren't reading any plays by women? In exactly one course did we do some plays by women. So I started wondering what it was that women weren't allowed to write plays or couldn't write plays, and I started digging. And I found quite a lot of plays by women, some of which were actually very successful in their time.
So I dug a little too, and I came across a 2010 Writers Institute event titled Rediscovered Early 20th Century Plays by Women to be presented as staged readings. These stage readings were based on your book.
Yes.
About playwrights, women playwrights.
Yes, they were. And one of the plays, which was very funny, went on, it was a rediscovered play, and it became very popular, a play called Mocking Owl. It was done in New York, and it was done at the National Theatre in London, and I wrote the program notes for that.
Is there or was there a particular woman playwright that especially grabbed your interest?
Well, there were a whole lot of them. When I first started a course in women playwrights, but people would come up to me and say, Lillian Hellman, and who? Susan Glaspell, who's had quite a renaissance in the past couple of years, and there is a Susan Glaspell Society. She was one of the major playwrights with Provincetown Players. Anna Cora Mowat, who was writing in the 19th century and was very popular at that time. I reprinted her play, her most famous play. Zona Gale, who wrote Miss Lulu Bett, which was performed many times. Georgia Douglas Johnson, who was an African-American playwright. It's a short play that she wrote, but it's a very powerful play. It disappeared. It's hard for a novel to disappear. If it's printed, there's a copy somewhere. Plays are not always printed. Sometimes all that survives is the script, and sometimes not even that. It makes it easier for theater historians to ignore them.
The very powerful play, Judy, by Georgia Douglas Johnson. Can you give us a little idea of what that was about?
It's about an impoverished African-American mother with a very sick daughter. And the question she faces is whether to use the last of her small funds for an operation she's convinced will not help her daughter, or to save the money to give her daughter a proper send-off, a funeral that shows how much she cared about the girl, like the funeral that she sees going by the window with the horses and the plumes. And she has to make that heartbreaking choice. For those of us today with all of the miracles of modern medicine, it's very hard for us to understand what it was like more than a century ago for a poor African-American woman to trust a doctor who has not been able to help her before.
And perhaps, Judy, open our eyes and hearts to people today who face similar heartbreaking choices.
One of the other aspects of it is that she has her friend there, Tildy, and she and Tildy speak the same language. The doctor does not understand them at all. And at the very end, Charity is sewing a dress for the girl. If the girl lives, it'll be short. If the girl dies, it will be her funeral gown. And the last line is Charity telling Sister Tildy, rip the hem out.
Talking about finding commonality and developing empathy.
Absolutely. And in this case, it's women whose voices haven't been heard nearly as much. I know there was a campaign a few years ago, I don't know if it's still going, called 50-50 in hopes that we would get 50% of the plays that were presented by women. But there's also the time factor. If you're reading a play about the turn of the 20th century, someone born in the 21st century, it's going to be a whole different world. And you have to begin to try to put yourself into that world and not condemn it because it wasn't as aware as you are now. And of course, the Passover story also, as an example of narrative, it connects you with your own culture if you're Jewish, because I'm sure that my ancestors, centuries ago, lived a life I can't even possibly imagine. And one of the fun things, we used to have seders, my friends and I used to, was bringing people who had never been to a seder before. They're learning about the story, so it becomes a reinforcement for those who know the story, and I think pretty eye-opening for those who don't.
That interview was from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
High pressure will continue to allow for dry and mainly clear conditions to tomorrow. Temperatures will be trending above normal by tomorrow. Continued dry weather is expected for Tuesday through the rest of the week, with temperatures becoming unseasonably warm by Thursday. The next chance of rain may not be until the upcoming weekend. Now for the official National Weather Service forecast for the Capital Region. Monday, sunny. Highs in the mid-60s. Southwest winds around 5 miles per hour, becoming west around 5 miles per hour in the afternoon. Monday night, mostly clear in the evening, then becoming mostly cloudy. Not as cool with lows around 40. West winds around 5 miles per hour, becoming south after midnight. Tuesday, partly sunny in the morning, then becoming mostly cloudy. Highs in the upper 60s. Southwest winds 5 to 10 miles per hour, becoming west around 15 miles per hour with gusts up to 25 miles per hour in the afternoon. And for the Schoharie Valley and higher terrain, Monday, sunny. Not as cool with highs in the lower 60s. West winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Monday night, mostly clear in the evening, then becoming mostly cloudy. Not as cool with lows around 40. West winds around 5 miles per hour. Tuesday, partly sunny in the morning, then becoming mostly cloudy. Highs in the lower 60s. West winds 10 to 15 miles per hour with gusts up to 25 miles per hour.
Make a decision. Every man could walk this earth on equal conditions.
Was Archie Shepp with Attica Blues on the radio at WGXC 90.7 FM.
WGXC has a new call-in number for anyone to leave a three-minute message that we will play back on the air. Listeners can leave as many three-minute audio letters to the editor at 518-212-7509 as they want, and WGXC will let your voice be heard on the local airwaves. The number again to call in and record a three-minute message that will be played back on 90.7 FM is 518-212-7509.
The name of this tune is Mississippi Goddamn. I mean every word of it. Alabama's gotten me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi Goddamn. Alabama's gotten me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows. Stand the pressure much longer. Somebody say a prayer. Alabama's gotten me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi Goddamn. This is a show tune, but the show hasn't been written for it yet. Hound dogs on my trail, school children sitting in jail, black cat cross my path, I think every day's gonna be my last. Lord have mercy on this land of mine, we all gonna get it in due time. I don't belong here, I don't belong there, I've even stopped believing in prayer. Don't tell me, I'll tell you. Me and my people just about do. I've been there, so I know. Keep on saying, go slow. But that's just the trouble. Washing the windows. The cotton, you're just plain rotten, you're too damn lazy, you're thinking it's crazy, where am I going, what am I doing, I don't know, I don't know,
you thought I was kidding you. Picket lines, school boycotts, they try to say it's a communist plot. All I want is equality for my sister, my brother, my people, and me. Yes, you lied to me all these years. You told me to wash and clean my ears and talk real fine just like a lady, and you'd stop calling me Sister Sadie. Oh, this whole country is full of lies. You are gonna die and die like flies. I don't trust you anymore. You keep on saying go slow. Go slow. But that's just the trouble. Desegregation. Mass participation. Unification.
But I know a change gonna come.